Hi there, welcome to Bond Investment Mentor. I'm your host, Chris Nelson, and this is a podcast dedicated to helping community financial institutions master the art of fixed income investments. If you're working for a community bank or credit union, and you have responsibilities for the investment portfolio, you've come to the right place. I'll be your personal investment guide as we help you boost your fixed income investment knowledge, level up your portfolio management skills, and help you gain the know-how you need to help your institution achieve its financial goals. In this episode, I'm going to tackle a question from a listener who wants to know more about a mortgage investment type called hybrid ARMs. We're going to explore what hybrid ARMs are and why an investor might consider using them in the investment portfolio. We'll also discuss some of the latest happenings with interest rates and the bond markets. So settle in, get ready, and let's get started. Hi there. Welcome back to Bond Investment Mentor. I'm Chris Nelson, and I'm glad that you decided to join me today. Today, we're going to take a look at a type of mortgage security that's a little different from the rest of the pack. They're called hybrid ARMs, and we're going to learn what they are and how they work. We're also going to check in on the latest from our friends at the Federal Reserve and the bond markets. Plus, I'm going to share some information I came across that I thought would be helpful in managing the investment portfolio during times of uncertainty. Not that that's been happening at all this year. So let's start by catching up with the latest from the financial reality show As the Fed Turns. At their most recent meeting, the Federal Open Market Committee voted to raise short-term interest rates by 75 basis points for the fourth consecutive time, taking the Fed funds rate to a range of 3.75 to 4%, which is its highest level since early 2008. They also provided a little clarification about what their next steps could be. In the announcement that accompanied the rate decision, the FOMC added a statement that I thought was noteworthy, and here's what it said. The committee anticipates that ongoing increases in the target range will be appropriate in order to attain a stance of monetary policy that is sufficiently restrictive to return inflation to 2% over time. In determining the pace of future increases in the target range, the committee will take into account the cumulative tightening of monetary policy, the lags with which monetary policy affects economic activity and inflation, and economic and financial developments. The bond markets took this new language in the FOMC statement as a sign that the Fed was ready to begin tapering its pace of monetary tightening. So initially, we saw a rally in the Treasury curve, particularly on the short end. However, the euphoria was short-lived once Fed Chair Jerome Powell spoke at the press conference after the FOMC meeting. During the press conference, Powell acknowledged that slowing the pace of rate hikes was something to consider. However, he also added that the level at which the Fed finally stops raising rates, the so-called terminal rate, was likely to be higher than first expected. He didn't give any specifics about what that level might be, but he cautioned that rates could be headed higher next year. Powell added that he thought it was premature to think about pausing and said that, quote, "we think we have a ways to go." This comment caught the markets a little off guard, as some had already begun to expect we were close to the Fed pivoting away from higher rates and at least being on hold as we moved into 2023. As a result, the bond market rally that I mentioned earlier fizzled, and rates rebounded to about where they were before the FOMC decision was announced. Looking at the Fed funds futures market, as I'm recording this, the current outlook is for the FOMC to raise rates by 50 basis points when they meet again in December, which is what the markets were anticipating before this week's meeting. And it would put rates in line with the Fed's September summary of economic projections. Where things have changed is the outlook for the meetings early next year. While the previous outlook was for the possibility of a 25 basis point move at the FOMC's first meeting of the year in February, Fed funds futures prices indicate about a 65% probability of a half point move now. After that, the outlook for additional moves by the Fed tails off by May or June of next year, which is a little further out than originally expected. One thing that I found interesting is the FOMC's acknowledgement of the lagged effect that monetary policy changes have. Generally, the rule of thumb is that it takes about 9 months for the full effects of an FOMC rate change to be felt throughout the economy. Given where we are on the calendar now, we are just beginning to feel the full impact of the quarter and half point hikes from this past spring, and that's well before the round of 75 basis point moves kicked in. Technically, the economy won't have absorbed those rate hikes until we're approaching Q2 next year, and this is one reason why economists are predicting a possible recession for the U.S. economy then. One thing's for sure, the volatile market environment isn't going anywhere, and there's still plenty of data to come in the weeks and months ahead. So the bumpy ride is likely to continue as we head into 2023. Okay, so with all of that behind us, let's take a look at where the markets are currently trading. As I'm recording this, the two-year Treasury yield is at 4.66%. Looking further out on the curve, the yield on the five-year Treasury is at 4.33%, and the 10-year benchmark Treasury is yielding 4.16%. Meanwhile, the yield curve inversion continues. The slope between two-year and 10-year Treasuries is currently minus 51 basis points. That is the largest curve inversion that we have seen since October 1984, so it's been a while. Another measurement of the yield curve slope has started to gain more attention as well, and that is the slope between 3-month treasuries and 10-year treasuries. This is a metric that the Federal Reserve has traditionally kept an eye on in the past, and it has been a somewhat reliable indicator of future recessions when it goes negative, which is why it's getting more attention now. As I'm recording this, the slope between the 3-month and 10-year Treasury yield is currently at minus 4 basis points. Now, I do want to add a little context to this current 3-month, 10-year slope measure. While the slope between the 3-month and 10-year parts of the Treasury curve is negative, the entire curve itself is not fully inverted. We still have some positive slope between the 3-month and 1-year parts of the curve. Now, granted, that's not much of the curve that's in play that still has a positive slope, but it is something that will be worth keeping an eye on moving forward. With the selling pressure that we saw in the bond markets during October, it's safe to say that last month was another not fun month for fixed income investors at community financial institutions. Over the course of October, the two-year Treasury yield rose by 20 basis points, while the five-year Treasury yield gained 14 basis points. On the long end of the curve, the 10-year Treasury yield increased by 22 basis points. The weakness in the bond markets no doubt resulted in further pressure on unrealized losses. The degree of losses your institution experiences will depend in part on when your bond accounting provider takes its monthly valuation for different security types. If you're not sure of when that is, it would be worth reaching out to your bond accounting contact to find out what day of the month your securities are valued. Knowing that will make it a little easier to gauge what's going on in the portfolio given shifts in the bond markets each month. As we all know, it's been a wild and volatile environment this year for the bond market and for fixed income portfolio managers at community financial institutions. The atmosphere of uncertainty has made managing the portfolio more challenging than ever, and I've spoken to many community bankers who frankly just feel shell-shocked. I think most everyone knows and expects that managing an investment portfolio is going to have its share of uncertainty, especially given the portfolio's complexities and moving parts. As a portfolio manager, you need to be ready for the curveballs that come your way. But what can you do to help yourself be prepared? I came across an article in the Harvard Business Review that I wanted to share with you. While the topic was about leading through uncertainty, I thought it had a lot of applicability to the day-to-day challenges of investment portfolio management. The article talks about 6 steps you can use to shift your perspective and adopt a good mindset when uncertainty rears its ugly head. So let's get to the 6 steps. Step number 1 is to embrace the discomfort of not knowing. The article talks about moving from what they call a know-it-all to a learn-it-all mindset. It can feel a little uncomfortable to not have all the answers up front, but acknowledging that you don't know is part of the learning process and can remove some of the pressure that you might feel in that moment. This was a lesson that I learned early on as a young portfolio manager. At first, I pressured myself because of what I perceived as a need to anticipate and have the answers ahead of time, particularly ahead of meetings. However, I learned that the world didn't end when someone asked a question, and my response was, you know, that's a good question. I don't have the answer to that right now, but I will find out and follow up with you if that's okay. In my experience, I never had anyone disagree. This approach gave me the time to learn what I needed to know and provide a better response, and it helped reduce my internal stress in the process. The second step is to distinguish between complicated and complex issues. Many of us use these two terms interchangeably, but they really represent two different types of situations. The article explains that the term complicated refers to something that may be difficult or highly technical, but which can be broken down into parts, allowing you to work toward a solution on your own, with help from your team, or by calling in outside help. Examples of this might include things like tax laws or accounting rules. In comparison, complex situations are made up of many interdependent elements. In addition to the number of variables, some of the variables may change over time and in unpredictable ways. Sound familiar? This description sounds like many of the challenges we face in managing the investment portfolio. Finding solutions for complex challenges is different than for complicated ones. In this case, with complex challenges, you'll generally get to an answer through a process of trial and error, and you have to be okay with taking a more flexible approach and be willing to learn and adapt along the way. The third step to managing uncertainty is to let go of perfectionism. The article discusses that trying to shoot for perfection in a complex environment is a waste of time. Instead, it is better to aim for making progress, learning from mistakes made, and acknowledging that you have the ability to make course corrections if necessary. Personally, this is a step that I am constantly working on. After being a recovering perfectionist for 30 plus years, I still find myself tempted to come up with the perfect solution to a portfolio challenge or a shift in market conditions. But I know that because things are in a constant state of flux, trying to do so is really a fool's errand. What I found is better is taking an incremental, step-by-step approach that allows me to adapt as conditions change, and they will, learn from the process and mistakes I might make, and make adjustments as I execute on my investment strategy. Okay, let's move on to step number four, which is to resist oversimplification and quick conclusions. It can be tempting to take a complex situation and try to boil it down to something simpler. I think it's just human nature, especially if we're action-oriented. We want to make challenges easier to tackle. But in trying to simplify the challenge, we run the risk of oversimplifying. When that happens, there's a chance that we become too narrowly focused and possibly miss important and relevant information that could be critical to developing a solution. And the more complex the environment, the more potential there is to want to simplify. Think about everything that's been happening in the bond markets and in your institution's investment portfolio over the past few months. With all the twists, turns, and moving parts, I can see how someone might want to boil things down in an effort to get on top of the situation. But in many cases, doing so leads to making potential mistakes that only compound the existing situation and potentially more headaches and heartburn. The key to avoiding oversimplification is to balance the need for action with a disciplined approach that allows time to understand the core problem and any complexities or variables. Slowing down just a little also gives you a chance to be sure that your decisions aren't based on personal biases or a too narrow perspective. Step number five in managing uncertainty is what I consider the secret sauce of the six steps. It's pretty simple. Don't go it alone. As I've talked with many community bankers over the years, I've met people who have told me about feeling isolated as they try to deal with the uncertainties and challenges of managing the investment portfolio. In the article, they say that some of this isolation comes from a belief that the person feels the need to solve all the issues themselves. However, as the workload grows and complexities increase, it becomes harder to do that, and you can begin to feel overwhelmed. You feel like you're drowning in a sea of uncertainty and start to move toward analysis paralysis. It is in these moments that having a network of people to whom you can reach out becomes vital. Being able to have a conversation with someone who understands what you're going through and can provide fresh perspective can be so valuable, especially when times feel uncertain. One of the best investments I've made in my own personal and professional development is cultivating my own personal network. It's a blend of friends, colleagues, and other professionals that I can turn to when I have questions, need help from someone with experience, or get guidance, fresh thinking, and encouragement during challenging times. And it's why I offer one-on-one mentoring to provide community bankers with someone they can reach out to for help with investment, banking, and finance questions. And soon, I'm going to be offering group mentoring as well. More to come on that. Regardless of how you do it, take the time to create a network that you can tap into to help manage things during periods of uncertainty. Finally, step number 6 in managing uncertainty is to zoom out. When you're in the midst of facing a challenge, you can become stuck because you're too immersed. Zooming out, or taking a step back, provides you with a look at the big picture. This broader perspective on the issues at hand can reveal things that you might otherwise have missed. When you zoom out, it becomes easier to see variables and other factors that might help with developing solutions or help prevent new challenges from arising. Stepping back also allows you to be more adaptable and able to make course corrections if needed. So those are the 6 steps to managing uncertainty. To recap, they are 1, embrace the discomfort of not knowing. 2, distinguish between complicated and complex issues. 3, let go of perfectionism. 4, resist oversimplification and quick conclusions. 5, don't go it alone. And 6, zoom out. Lately, it seems we've had a constant barrage of reminders that we really can't control much of the change, complexity, and uncertainty that's out there and that affects our investment portfolios. But by using these 6 strategies, we can improve our ability to learn, reduce our stress, and navigate the complexity of the investment world we live in. Okay. Moving on to today's main topic, and it comes from a question that I received from Brad, who is a community banker in Pennsylvania. Brad said to me, "Hi, Chris. I'm a regular investor in mortgage-backed securities for my bank and have been talking with brokers about hybrid ARMs. I'm not as familiar with them and would like to learn more about them. Would you walk through what they are and anything that's important to know?" Well, first, thank you, Brad, for your question. Let's take a look at hybrid ARMs, their pros and cons, and reasons why they might be a useful tool in managing the investment portfolio. Hybrid ARMs are like other mortgage securities in that they are a pool of residential mortgage loans, and as borrowers make their monthly loan payments, they are distributed to all the investors in the mortgage-backed security. Usually, when we're talking about mortgage securities, we're referring to fixed-rate MBS. In other words, loans with 10, 15, 20, or 30-year amortizations and a fixed interest rate. But hybrid ARMs are structured a little differently. In terms of principal cash flow, hybrid ARMs have a 30-year amortization like a standard 30-year fixed-rate mortgage security. But unlike the 30-year MBS pool, the interest rate structure is different. Let's start with the term ARM, which is an acronym that stands for Adjustable Rate Mortgage. Unlike a traditional fixed-rate mortgage where interest rates never change, the interest rate on an ARM periodically adjusts or resets. The reason that these securities are called hybrid ARMs is that the mortgage rate structure is a blend of a fixed and a variable rate. During the first phase of a hybrid ARM's life, the rate is fixed for a specified number of years. The most common fixed rate periods available today are for 5 years, 7 years, and 10 years. So for the first few years of a hybrid ARM's life, it acts like a traditional fixed rate mortgage. Once the fixed rate period is up, however, the mortgage shifts to an adjustable rate structure with the interest rate on the mortgage periodically resetting. The rate is determined based on an index and a rate spread. In the past, the 1-year Treasury and LIBOR rates were used as indices, but now the common index is the 30-day average SOFR rate, which is based on the newer secured overnight financing rate that was created to replace LIBOR. For example, a hybrid ARM might have an adjustable rate structure of 30-day SOFR plus 225 basis points. So if the SOFR rate is 3% at the time of reset and the spread is 225 basis points, then the new rate on the mortgages would be 5.25%. This would be the rate until the next reset. Now, in the past, the rate on a hybrid ARM would reset annually, but today, most hybrid ARMs now reset every 6 months. So before we go any further, let's consider why a borrower may want to use a hybrid ARM instead of a traditional fixed-rate mortgage. And there are three possible reasons that I came up with. First, hybrid ARMs typically offer more attractive rates than a traditional fixed-rate mortgage, which would reduce the size of the monthly payment for the borrower, might make it more appealing. Another reason is that the borrower believes that interest rates might drop before the mortgage rate resets, resulting in a lower monthly payment. And finally, a borrower might choose a hybrid ARM structure if they are only planning to live in the property for a shorter period of time than the 30 years normally associated with a fixed mortgage. It's reasons like these that creates a key characteristic of hybrid ARMs that investors need to keep in mind. For reasons like I just described, historically, the vast majority of hybrid ARM borrowers will prepay on their mortgage late in the fixed rate period before the first adjustable rate reset occurs. In general, an investor could see as much as 70 to 75% of borrowers paying off their existing hybrid ARM mortgage as they refinance into a new loan. This potential for this larger balloon payment of principal means that the weighted average life of the security is generally shorter than a traditional 30-year fixed-rate MBS. The weighted average life will be closer to the 5, 7, or 10-year fixed-rate period. Because of this, the duration is also usually shorter as well. Now, keep in mind, there may still be borrowers who stick around past the initial rate reset from fixed to floating, so an investor could still receive principal for a while. However, the security has now flipped to a variable rate structure, which helps to mitigate against the potentially longer balances. I experienced this when I was managing my bank's investment portfolio. When we reached the first rate reset on these securities, most of the borrowers were already gone, but there were still some who stuck around. I continued to receive monthly payments for several years afterward, but now the rate was resetting annually, so the security's effective duration was shorter and didn't create any unwanted extension risk. So far, hybrid ARMs sound pretty good. But there is something to keep in mind that could create headaches if you're not careful. The biggest concern is the potential effects of prepayment risk, particularly as the security approaches the reset date from fixed to variable. As I mentioned earlier, the vast majority of borrowers will typically prepay shortly before that first reset. This means that prepayment speeds will ramp up quickly, which could create issues if the investment was purchased at a premium. If you're investing in hybrid ARMs, you'll want to analyze how the yield will be affected at higher prepayment speeds to ensure you don't get burned down the road. This is where Bloomberg yield tables are so helpful, as you can run faster prepayment what-if scenarios to see what happens. And I'm talking some very high scenarios just to understand what it might look like. Now, if an investor purchases hybrid ARMs at a discount, it's a different story. That's because a faster prepayment speed allows for more rapid accretion of the discount and a yield enhancement in the process. So why should an investor consider hybrid ARMs for the investment portfolio? Well, first, hybrid ARMs generally have a shorter weighted average life, particularly the 5 and 7 year structures. Plus, the balloon nature of these mortgage securities helps to mitigate from potentially longer extension risk, like you might experience with other longer fixed rate mortgage backed securities. Plus, hybrid ARMs generally trade at slightly higher yield spreads, though that depends in part on market conditions at times. But if they're priced correctly, it would allow for a slightly better yield spread compared to other alternatives. So that's an overview of hybrid ARMs and their moving parts. And Brad, thanks again for your question. And if you have a question about fixed income securities, portfolio management, or anything banking and finance related, drop me a line at chris@bondinvestmentmentor.com. I answer every question I receive and would enjoy hearing from you. Before we wrap up for today, I want to take a moment to remind you about the free investment guides that I've created over at bondinvestmentmentor.com. There, you'll find three different resources that you can download, including my fixed income pre-purchase checklists. These due diligence checklists have been very popular over the years, and they will help you fine-tune your investment decision-making and organize your pre-purchase process to ensure that you have the answers you need both before and after the investment trade is executed. I've created 8 different worksheets covering everything from government bonds to mortgage securities to municipals and other investment types. Each of the worksheets contains areas to capture relevant trade information, the reasons for the purchase, and the risks associated with the investment. They also include a list of resources like Bloomberg screens and other info to help you in your bond analysis and evaluation. Using the checklist is a great way to ensure you have all the information you need before and after that investment purchase. You'll be able to cover your due diligence bases, organize your investment analysis, and feel more confident in your decision-making in the process. To download your copy of the pre-purchase checklists or any of the other investment guides, head over to bondinvestmentmentor.com and check them out. Well, again, I'm glad you stopped by, and I hope that you found the information in today's episode to be helpful. Thanks a lot for checking in. Bond Investment Mentor is written and produced by me, Chris Nelson, and the information, views, and opinions expressed during the podcast belong solely to myself. Any ideas and strategies contained within the podcast are for educational and informational purposes only and do not constitute investment, accounting, or legal advice. If you have a question regarding anything I covered today, please email me at chris@bondinvestmentmentor.com. I'd love to catch up with you. And if you think that somebody might benefit from this, please let them know about the podcast. Share the information with them. And if you haven't already, I'd like to invite you to subscribe to the podcast, and that way you won't miss an episode. If you'd like more information about fixed income investing and portfolio management, check out the website, bondinvestmentmentor.com, where you'll find articles, tips, and resources to help you manage your institution's investment portfolio and help you become a better portfolio manager, including those free investment guides I mentioned earlier. Also, I'd love to catch up with you on social media. You can follow me on LinkedIn at Christopher Nelson, CFA, and on Facebook at Bond Investment Mentor. I'd love to catch up and connect. I look forward to catching up with you again soon. Thanks for stopping by. Have a good one.